I idolized Beethoven from the beginning. The main reason I wanted to learn to play the piano was so I could play Beethoven.
So he decided to perform all 32 piano sonatas by Ludwig van Beethoven, and he did it from memory. How he was able to do it was the sort of thing Sue Halpern tried to find out for her book, Can't Remember What I Forgot. Halpern spent 5 years on the front lines of memory research, looking into the latest work in genetics, neuroscience, and cognitive psychology. And she put herself through a battery of tests and imaging techniques, motivated by her elderly father's memory problems. Anne Strainchamps began her conversation with Sue Halpern with a question that's troubled many an aging baby boomer.
How worried should the average person be about getting Alzheimer's?
I'm hopeful that the average person shouldn't be all that worried. I mean, that was sort of the bottom line when I finished the book, how I felt. So I'm hoping other people will feel that way as well for a couple of reasons. The first reason is statistically, Alzheimer's is a disease of old age. Most of us actually won't live long enough to get it. That's, you know, kind of a funny thing to say, and maybe we should want to, but most of us won't. The biggest risk factor for Alzheimer's disease is getting old. So statistically, maybe, you know, you can put yourself in that camp of people who probably won't get it. The other thing that's going on is that the research has become so good. The molecular biology, the genetics, the imaging technology have all become so sophisticated in the time that I've been working on the book. And I'm feeling incredibly hopeful that the kinds of drugs and the kinds of interventions that are now really, you know, coming to fruition will be the things that will make the numbers even more in our favor.
Have scientists definitively figured out yet what causes Alzheimer's? Because for a long time, that was mysterious.
Yeah, it's a funny thing. You know, science is very strange. There are most of us who think, you know, the way science works is, you know, they come up with a hypothesis, they prove it, it's done. We know from evolution that it doesn't quite work that way. There's a lot of muddiness in science. So with Alzheimer's disease, the dominant paradigm existed for a very long time, about 100 years. And the dominant paradigm said that an Alzheimer's brain is clogged up with plaques and tangles, and that when a person, you know, has these plaques and tangles, that they kill neurons and synapses and take away, you know, personality and words and orientation and all of that. More recently, the paradigm has shifted, and I can't say 100% that it's there yet, but I think the majority of neuroscientists now believe what's happening is that there's a toxic protein that builds up in an Alzheimer's brain, and it's that protein that kind of floods the brain and starts to kill synapses and with the synapses, neurons. And so when you see the plaques and tangles, that's sort of almost after the fact that the damage has already been done.
So where does this toxic protein come from? Do we all have it?
No. We all have the protein, but we don't all have it in the particular configuration that makes it toxic, makes it sticky. So that's the question. Where does the toxicity come from? How does it become this particular configuration? And one of the great findings of Alzheimer's research was a gene that was discovered that is an inherited gene that very, very few people get. But in discovering that, they could see how in those cases, which are early onset Alzheimer's, which happened to people, say, in their 30s and 40s, in those cases, they could see how that gene caused the body to produce this particular form of what is called beta amyloid. And once they knew that, then they could start looking for other ways in which that was occurring, other triggers to that process. And that's what they're finding now. That's what they're working on now. They found a couple, and they're getting, you know, closer and closer. And the reason why that becomes really important is because in the past, the drugs that have been used to help people with Alzheimer's have primarily addressed symptoms, and they haven't addressed causes. Mm. But now, once we've got this paradigm shift, and we've got these great images, and we've got this great molecular biology and genetics, we can start to develop drugs that are very targeted and that go to causes rather than symptoms. And that's where we're at, and it's very, very exciting.
So does the research on Alzheimer's extend to answering some basic questions about how memory works, and especially why for almost all of us it seems not to work as well the older we get? I mean, you know, I'm in my late 40s, and I know I forget much more than I did when I was 20. And not only that, but my mind, I think, works differently.
Your mind does work differently, and you're absolutely right. And so one of the things that's sort of funny, and I wrote about this a bit in the book, is that with most things in physiology, you sort of understand how normal works, and then you kind of go to the pathological. So that's the way it usually operates. But with memory, historically, its pathology has been the thing that people have understood better than normal. Normal, as one of the characters in my book says, is the new frontier. And one of the things that the researchers who are studying normal memory loss, which is different from pathological memory loss, one of the things that they found is that there are noticeable physiological changes in the brain as you age, you know, starting from when you're in your 20s. Your brain is kind of an evolving work of art all the way through your life. But your memory starts to decline, you know, starting when you're, say, in your 20s. And that's why if you were to take a memory test when you were 25 and then you were to take the same test when you were 35 and then when you were 45, you would continually do worse on most of the things, not everything, but on most of the things. And that's because there are physiological changes that are happening in your brain that are just, you know, an inevitable part of getting older.
Does this mean that the older we get, the less smart we are? Because I'd hate to think that my employer would hear this and decide that he should just replace all of us who are in our late 40s with 25-year-olds.
No, because there's a difference between memory and intelligence, and there's also a difference between memory and wisdom. And one of the things I write about is how, in fact, as you get older, your brain is a kind of a machine for pattern recognition that you don't have when you're younger. When you're younger, things look new to you. You know, you encounter them as novel experiences. But then as you get older, your brain has literally, the architecture of your brain has changed. So you can assess a situation, you can look at things, and are much more effective and efficient at sizing things up, at understanding in a way that younger people don't have.
You put yourself through a lot of different medical procedures in your effort to research the front lines of memory research. Tell me something about the different things you put yourself through, different forms of brain imaging.
Yeah, I decided that in order to really understand both what was going on in terms of memory research and also just the anxiety that people feel when they want to get their memory tested, I decided that I would get myself tested in every way possible. And so there are different kinds of brain imaging techniques. There are MRIs. And there are functional MRIs where they ask you to do a task while you're in the machine. And then there are some where they just take a picture of your brain when you're basically doing nothing. I did those, which are very sort of non-invasive. Then I did two different kinds of imaging that required me getting shot up with radioactive dye, which then, you know, eventually made its way into my brain. And again, in both of those times, there were structural tests or structural images made, and also when I was doing tasks, so they could see what parts of my brain were sort of lighting up, what parts were demanding more glucose, more energy.
Did they have to make you very radioactive?
Yes. In at least one case. I mean, it's funny, I sort of did that thing that people do when they're going to go get tested for anything. They sort of tried to ignore what was going on in my body. So they told me in the first time that when I was getting the radioactivity, that it was no more than having flown across the country, which I actually had done the day before. And I thought, okay, you know, and I just sort of accepted that. And later on, I thought, boy, that was dumb. Like, what was I thinking? But I did that. And then the other one was actually quite humorous. I went to a place called the Brookhaven National Lab, which is a high-energy physics research installation in Long Island that used to be a big army base. And mostly they do, you know, really, really high-level physics, but there's a kind of medical wing. And part of the medical wing is that they do nuclear medicine. And in this case, what they did was they actually took samples of my blood and they concocted a radioisotope specifically for my body. So while I was there, they got me all straightened up and put in various lines in my artery and vein, kind of put my head into a a foam helmet so I couldn't move. And then in another building, they were mixing up this radioisotope, and eventually it came and they inserted it into my vein. And when I was all done, they told me that I couldn't leave by the front door because I was so hot that I would make all the alarms go off.
That's not a little scary.
It did not give me great confidence. I was like, I just felt like, you know, I was kind of a walking time bomb or something.
Did you wonder if you would glow in the dark?
Exactly. And then they said, drink a lot of water. Wash your hands after you use the bathroom. I was like, oh, great. What have I done?
What about products you can take? Vitamins, minerals. I mean, walk down the aisle of any health food store or drugstore, you know, and the array is sort of dizzying of products that promise to improve your memory.
Yeah.
Do any of those work?
Not really. Originally, I had this idea of doing, you know, taking a lot of these products and seeing, you know, I sort of was going to try to set myself up to see if there was any improvement. You know, there's Focus Factor and there are these various memory boosters. And then I realized it was impossible as one person to do this as a kind of a scientifically valid way of testing anything, because you don't know how much, you know, when it's going to clear, how long you should take it. So I instead read all the literature, of which is quite extensive, because one of the things that's happening, you know, in science is that people are trying to figure out, are there things out there that already exist so that we don't have to reinvent the wheel? And so a lot of the stuff has gone through fairly rigorous testing, and none of it has come out sort of the other end with flying colors.
Really? All the things, I mean, by now, some of these are sort of fairly established. If you ask, you know, the proverbial man in the street, what should I try for my memory? Oh, ginkgo biloba, or
yeah,
you know, omega-3 fatty acids, or CoQ10.
All right. Omega-3s are a good thing, and they have been proved, and that's, yeah. It's just good for overall brain health. I don't know that anyone has done kind of serious memory testing on them, but overall, yes. But something like ginkgo is really interesting because the anecdotal evidence suggests that it's good for your memory. The tests that have been done haven't shown that. The ones that have been done sort of in the lab haven't come out that way. They've been at best mixed. The problem with a ginkgo is that in terms of dosing, people tend to, you know, they don't know quite how much they should be taking. They also don't understand that even though you find it on the health foods section of the supermarket or in the, you know, natural foods section, it's still a chemical. It still has a biochemical effect in your body. So people who take blood thinners, for instance, should not be taking ginkgo. I mean, it has certain physiological effects on you that are not benign. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the man in the street might think that, but that's only because anecdotally that's what the man in the street has heard, but that is not so smart. And if you're going to take anything, if you're going to swallow anything, you should clear it with the doctor first, because you have to understand what the interactions are and what your own physiology is and how it will react with that.
Is there anything that actually does work? You know, if you're a middle-aged person and you have quote-unquote normal forgetting and your brain function is gradually declining, is there anything that actually will improve your mental functioning?
Absolutely. That's really good news. While I was doing my research, one of the protocols that was being designed and then put into place was an exercise protocol. When a couple of years ago, maybe 10 years ago, a researcher at the Salk Institute in La Jolla, a guy named Fred Gage, determined that the body continues to make new neurons all the way through the life cycle. So it wasn't like we were born with a certain number and then they died off and then we got stupid. That doesn't happen. We actually continue to make neurons all the way through our lives. But one of the things that happens as we get older is that we produce fewer new neurons. So he discovered that. And then the question was, is there anything that could boost the production of neurons in your brain? And they did these mouse studies, and there were exercise studies, and it turned out that the mice that exercised had both improved memory function and also appeared to have the growth of new neurons. So then while I was doing the research on the book, they decided to do an exercise protocol to try to replicate the mouse protocol in people. And lo and behold, the exact same thing happened. The people who didn't exercise had no improvement in their memory, you know, 12 weeks after the fact. The people who exercised had better memory scores than they had when they started. The people who exercised the most had the best and then the most improvement. And then they did brain images, and they showed that the people who exercised had an increase in neurogenesis and the growth of new neurons.
Sue Halperin told Anne Strainchamps that she's an avid exerciser. She skis or bicycles through the countryside of Vermont, where she's a scholar in residence at Middlebury College. Her book's called Can't Remember What I Forgot: The Good News from the Front Lines of Memory Research.